Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 276 for February 27th. Ford Performance pushes the R&D envelope. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 p.m. Pacific, and that's 20 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Gary Vasilash. We got a hell of a show tonight.
We do. This will probably be the fastest show we've ever had.
We got to make it go fast because we got two guys here with racing and performance in their blood. We got Dave Parasek, head of Ford Performance. Yep. I think I got that right. And Jamie Allison, head of Ford Racing.
Part of Ford Performance.
As part of Ford Performance.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you guys must be in pig heaven. Pig heaven. Not just for the jobs that you got, but, man, what a month Ford Racing has had. You guys sweep Daytona, the 24 hours. You sweep the Speed Weeks in all the NASCAR stuff. I mean, it doesn't get any better than the way you've started.
It's not a bad start, Don. No, I tell you, I mean, it's not been done before, and we're really proud of the team and all of our, you know, our racing partners that we go out with on the track every weekend. So it's been, it's all the hard work throughout the off season has paid off. You know, the team spent a lot of time taking what happened last year. We had a good season last year, but figuring out, you know, what we can do better this year and working on it throughout the season. And we're 4-for-4 so far at Daytona. That's not bad.
So explain for our audience, for the people that don't know, I mean, what do you guys do? What is entailed by the performance activities of Ford?
Yeah, so we provide a lot of the engineering support for the race teams, right? And we give them support, whether it's working with them on aerodynamics or lightweighting or the engines, you know, everything about the race cars, right? Our team, Ford Performance, actually extends our engineering efforts towards our teams, and we support them in figuring out how we're going to race faster and better every weekend. And so we have a whole group that works, you know, underneath me doing that for each of the, you know, whether it be Roush or Penske or any of our partners. So yeah, we provide them the engineering services to make the cars go faster and run better.
But is it just racing, or are you guys doing more for
production? Well, that's what I want to talk about. So. Yeah. I mean, Ford Performance is taking our SVT organization, what was previously known as SVT, and our Team RS in Europe, and our Ford Racing, and pulling it all under one umbrella called Ford Performance. Mm-hmm. And the reason we're doing that is to gain the synergies by doing that within our company so that we can be more efficient in delivering vehicles and products and tools faster, right? Bring it to market faster. And then at the same time, we're going to use racing as our test bed, if you will, for innovation, technology development, people development, so that we can, at the end of the day, make our entire company better as a result of our efforts out on the track.
So do you embed engineers with the teams, or
we do?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, we have a whole team of engineers that work very closely with those teams, and they're with them all the time, whether they're at their own shops or whether they're, you know, here in Dearborn. You know, we do a lot of exchange with those teams. I mean, they come to us, we go to them. And we spend a lot of time together as one big team to get it all done. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of people to make a car go around the track fast.
We just had Joe Hendrickson here for the TV show Auto Line this week, and was asking him, what's all this performance stuff about? And he said that the performance segment in the U.S. market has grown 70% since 2009. And I was blown away. I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the demand for performance vehicles is there. And, you know, if you look at even like some of our ST products, the millennials are purchasing the ST products at twice the rate that they purchase just normal Ford products. So the demand for performance vehicles is there. And look, we do it because it allows us to do all the things I talked about with innovation and technology development. But it also is profitable growth for us. I mean, it supports our one Ford plan.
Right. Well, you know, I said this years and years and years ago, you know, BMW, Mercedes, AMG, they cracked the code, right? You put in $5,000 more of equipment and charge $25,000 more for the car. So to me, it's like easy to make the business case work.
Yeah, especially, obviously, Dave mentioned about the STs, plus they're a great entry point to get new customers into the Ford brand. a lot of some of the millennials find a lot of attraction in some of our performance vehicles. So having those brands appeal to a millennial who will then consider additional Fords as they kind of progress through the lineup of Ford.
Look, Fiesta ST, in for my money, is the best bang for the buck any enthusiast can spend.
Absolutely.
That's a heck of a car, right? And now we just announced that we're doing a Focus RS, and wait until you get behind the wheel of that one.
I will next week. I can't wait. Henrik said that you guys are going to have a dozen performance vehicles by the end of the decade, I think.
By 2020, yep.
So let's see. There's Fiesta ST, Focus ST, Focus RS, Mustang GT 350R, Raptor, Ford GT. What am I missing here? Help me out, guys.
That's pretty good math.
I know.
That's pretty good math.
And that's not bad. He was running out of fingers there. Well, you know, we don't talk about all of our future plans, but you captured a lot of them.
Yeah. So you got a great breadth of the market represented with performance vehicles. CUV CUVs, SUVs. I mean,
these are things you want to see, or what are you asking?
Well, I'm asking.
You're going to run out of cars. You're going to have to put them in.
Yeah, you got to do something.
You're
going to
do something else, right? You got the Raptor for the pickup truck, and
I know.
But I mean, if you think about what you just listed, I mean, no other brand has such a breadth of lineup, all the way from small cars, all the way to a two-door sports coupe, all the way to a truck, all with performance derivatives. And then, the synergy of taking those performance brands and put them in racing, the connection between racing and performance development, that's the synchronization that's taking place within Ford. So we're really just absolutely, just at the beginning of a journey of actually showcasing what's possible in the realm of performance.
Any possibility of tying Ford R&D, the Scilabs, into this? And the reason I ask is, when you go and look at an Audi, their racing largely does not come out of their marketing budget. It comes out of their R&D budget. And they're very upfront that this is a development effort for us, not just a marketing effort.
Well, and I think that's what, you're seeing happening within what we're doing with Ford Performance. We are shifting that. So marketing is a huge part of going racing with the activation and everything that marketing does to do that. But it is, you asked about R&D, absolutely they'll be involved in what we do. Because, again, this is going to be innovation, technology development, tool development. I mean, this is, we're doing some cutting-edge stuff here. So the R&D team will be involved in that. And, within Ford, we're aligning it more under the product development group, with marketing as our partner and everything else, right, as we go forward. But it's really going to be under Raj Nair, Raj, right, and his leadership. And so I report directly to Raj. And so it's going to be more of a PD-centric because, as you asked, what do you guys do? We engineer for the racetrack, and we engineer for the driveway, right? So it's in the PD community now.
But you said an interesting thing there, tool development. Is this on the manufacturing side, or you mean design tools or what?
Good.
Yeah, increasingly, look at NASCAR. There is no testing allowed individually by the teams. So hence the reliance on advanced tools, simulation, racing simulators, all those that may have evolved in racing are increasingly crossbred with road car application. So our engineers working on computer-aided engineering, computer-aided tools, all those feed into our teams to prepare for racing, but more importantly, intersects with development engineers who are using them for road car application.
See, this is music to my ears because, the domestic automakers have always talked the talk. Yeah. I'm not sure that they always walked it, and it was always racing improves the breed. And, I was maybe here and there, but this seems to be a different strategy by the Ford Motor Company, and a very new strategy too.
Yeah, and I'm glad you noticed that. And one of the things you notice, we don't have Ford Racing shirts on.
No, and Ford Performance.
But the reason is because we don't race to race, we race to perform, and that's a difference, right? Because it is going to affect the whole product lineup at the Ford Motor Company. Not just, hey, you did a great race car and you went out and you won the Daytona 500. How does that translate into someone's driveway? How do you take what you've learned out on that track, whether it be the tools that we've developed and then therefore using them for product development and getting cars to the market faster, or new innovations that we've developed out on the racetrack and put it through the test? And one of the proof points of that, John, I think, is we introduced the Ford GT at the Detroit Auto Show. I think everybody knows. If you don't know by now, you're probably the last person on the planet.
You've been living under a rock.
But the engine that is going to exist in that car has been proven on the racetrack. We raced it last year, Daytona Prototype in the IMSA Series, won several races. This year, we kicked off the season, as you said, with the Rolex 24, winning it with that engine, that very engine that we're proving out on the track that will live inside the GT that will be in people's driveways. So that's how you tie all this together.
So was there a cultural shift within the organization that said we've got to make this part of our everyday existence rather than a Sunday event in terms of developing vehicles for racing and for
the
driveway?
You can build it if you'd like.
I think we talk a lot about it, about what kind of led to this, is that, you know, One Ford, right? We are a company that have come together under the mantra One Ford. Well, one of the last bastion of needed to be One Ford is the fact that we had these regional and fractionalized activities within Ford, all things about performance. Dave talked about, under Dave now is SVT, TMRS, Ford Racing, Performance Business. Well, they were all regional, and they were all in separate functions. Not anymore. We're all aligned under single leadership and bringing all these activities that were disparate around the world fully aligned to execute. So we talk about cultural shift. It's a part of One Ford. It's just, for the last bastion, if you be part of One Ford.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a continuation of the cultural shift that has been happening.
Right, so it's very deliberate, very
codified
how you're going to go about doing this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's very deliberate.
And very global. So I got to imagine you have programs for Latin America, Europe, Asia, and whatnot.
Absolutely global. Yep. And all the global, all the performance teams that are around the world are all aligned with underneath me. And as we do our design reviews and everything that we do now, it's done globally. Where before, as Jamie said, it was done regionally and disconnected. In fact, I just reviewed a global program this morning in a forum that was their first time there. And they said, this is great that we're actually all talking one group to one, in one leadership chain, as opposed to five different leaders or five different groups. And so it's really working well.
So it's the One Ford philosophy applied to racing and performance.
It absolutely is. Yeah.
When you guys talk about an EcoBoost engine being in, say, the Ford GT, it's not the sort of EcoBoost that John and I can go out and buy right now.
Oh.
I mean.
Go ahead.
It is literally, we started with the EcoBoost engine from the Taurus show. It's the same block. Same head. 70% of the parts that are found in the Daytona prototype winning car are production pieces.
Wow.
So that's really the holy grail, the little code that we unlocked, and that is we want to be able to say, we want to be able to use the track as a proof point, as a validation, as a showcase, and then pick the best of breed and apply it to production application and vice versa. So indeed, it is. Yeah.
No, it really is. Absolutely. And, Jamie and I, at the time, we were in separate groups. I was the chief engineer of Mustang, and he was running Ford Racing. We did the Boss 302, and, that was a really a huge hit for us. But when we were going through that project and we developed the new engine that was going to be in the Boss 302, the first phone call I got was from him, and he said, hey, I need a new engine to race. We should do this together. And, oh, by the way, I need 10 engines now. I literally had 10 engines that I was going to build prototypes with that I shipped over to Jamie. And what we did was together we worked where – as we were developing on the track and what we were learning from a cooling perspective and overall, calibration and performance, we were feeding back into the production program so that at the end of the day, the car that was in the showroom that every customer could go by was the Boss 302R that he was racing out on the track. Same engine. And everybody benefited from that, right? The road car was great. The race car was great. So it's just an extension of that in a much larger form that we're doing across the company now.
Wow. As you look out, how do you make your decisions as to where you should be? I mean, there's F1, there's LMP1, there's WRC, there's DTM. How do you say pick and choose where you're going to get the biggest bang?
Yeah, Dave and I talk a lot about this. So there are places where we are in racing because of the absolute just scale of it. And then obviously we're in NASCAR because of the reach and the scale of NASCAR. 70% of all U.S. households, 70 million fans. So NASCAR is about reach and scale. And then in NASCAR, it's about the tools, about the engineering, it's about the outreach. In other places, as Dave was talking about, in IMSA, in GS, where we raced the Boss 302, or in DP, where we're racing the EcoBoost, that is purely about product and technology relevance. Being able to say, it was born here, it was developed here, and it improved our road car application. And there's other places, we were just talking about it in the car, like rallycross or gymkhana or drifting. Those are, you know, adventure, action-style sports, and they're followed mostly on, you know, on social media, and that's where you reach young millennials around the world who just want to see something very
spectacular. Watch those
Ken
Block,
right?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. That's
yeah.
the best. Those are
every Saturday morning, my son gets up, and he says, Dad, can I watch The Crazy Guy?
Right? Oh, it's just...
So, I mean, you know, it's been a huge hit for us. Go ahead and finish
yeah,
your thought.
Yeah, but that's really, you ask how we make those determination. We look at what our objectives are, and then we look for those series that meet our objectives. So action sports for outreach and millennials, and for global nature, because obviously social media, and then IMSA and sports car racing for product technology relevance, and NASCAR for basically the awe, spectacle, and scale and reach in North America.
And as I mentioned, we're going through, you know, we're evaluating everything that we're doing in racing right now, especially under the new organization, and we're making sure we don't go racing just to race, right? So if a series or if it doesn't serve the greater need of the company and the corporation, if it's not a great place for us to innovate and develop tools and technologies and whatnot and reach the customers that we want to reach, then it's not a place for us to be.
Is there something about the cars looking more like real cars? You know, because I'm thinking, you know, Ford Cosworth engines used to be in Indy cars and F1 racing and things like that, but that doesn't look like a customer car. That's a special sort of thing, right?
Yep. So we have a goal that as we continue to evolve this organization, and you will see a better linkage between the racetrack and the showroom. Visually and functionally, you know, with all, I mean... On the part of Ford.
Or let's talk motor racing in general then, because, I mean, virtually every series, is my understanding, is pretty much losing viewership. You know, I'd love to get some of your guys' insights on how you keep it relevant and how you attract a new generation.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Motorsports is, to some, is a form of entertainment, right? And it's a show to some. To us, it's our industry. You know, we are a car company. This is car racing. This is our intersection. So to us, there's a broader perspective, and that is around technology, relevance, pride, you know, a whole host of things, consumer outreach. There's a whole host of things that are relevant to us. But you talk about, in general, the consumption of motorsports. We got the series are very mindful of the fact that there's now competition for consumption. You know, there's other forms of entertainment that's out there. But live sports, which is what auto racing is, continues to percolate as a high interest among viewership. So I think adjustment of formats, adjustments of the forms is all the dials that series have to do.
Yeah, I think it's all about relevance, right? And I, as Jamie said, we are meeting with all the different series and as manufacturers, not just Ford, but as manufacturers together, to make sure that we're modifying formats and technologies and things that will make it relevant to everyone and keep that as something that people want to go be entertained with. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's an acknowledgement, a very serious acknowledgement, that it's time to increase and improve the relevance of the sport to today's time. And so I'm really encouraged by it because what we see happening, I think, is very cool. And so we think that there's a great future for the racing in general.
I was wondering, you know, we mentioned earlier in passing the Raptor that you guys unveiled at the Detroit show.
Yeah.
And the frame of that is different than the frame in the production truck. And I've got to, you know, and this sort of gets back to John's question about tooling.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's got to be some real tooling that is made to make that frame differently. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, what is the breadth that performance can have when it comes to developing these vehicles?
Well, I mean, so when you say what is the breadth? As far as what influence do we have over the...
Well, I mean, if you can make a new frame.
Right.
You know, I mean, what are your limitations? Presumably, somebody says, you know, you...
Okay. So at a high level, at a tech, there's no limitations that we have. It's all in... We obviously, these vehicles that we make, we want to be profitable. And so we want to control our spending. And we don't, you know... I mean, there's really no limitations. We can go as far as we want to go. But if you look at the frame that is different on the Raptor, it is different and it is unique. But it's in a modular design, so we can modify pretty easily.
Okay, and we're going to come back to this topic in a minute, but we're going to have to take a quick break here shortly because we got to give a shout-out to our good friends at Firestone. Well, I had said we have to give a shout-out to Firestone. I meant to say Bridgestone. But the two are tied together, so I guess that's okay.
Yeah, so we were in...
We were talking about manufacturing.
Manufacturing, and so, you know, our assembly plants are all flexible. Mm-hmm. They can handle quite a bit of complexity. So we're really not limited by anything other than making sure that we have the best value position for the customer and that we achieve our performance targets. And then we do it in the most efficient way possible. So we'll modify or change or do whatever we need to do to make that that performance vehicle do what it's supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But again, we are very modular and we have flexible plants. So we really do have more flexibility than I think people really realize.
Mm-hmm. I got to believe when you get to building the Ford GT, there's a lot of manufacturing lessons that the company's going to be watching very carefully for potentially future vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, the Ford GT is going to bring a whole host of new technologies and processes in order to put that car together. But, you know, we're excited about it, and we're working through that right now. And, yeah, there's no doubt that our goal, that's a halo product for Ford Performance and for the Ford Motor Company. And we're going to debut a lot of technologies on it that will ultimately make their way, you know, throughout the rest of the lineup.
And I'll ask you guys, even though I don't expect to get an answer, are you going to take it to Le Mans next year?
You're the first guy that's ever asked that.
Yeah.
Wow.
When is spring training with a tiger?
Yeah.
I'm tired of that snow.
John, you know, we've only announced that we have a great production car available.
Yeah. And the rest of us have noted that next year is the 50th anniversary of Ford's classic win there, too.
It is. Yeah, that's, yeah. 1, 2, and 3.
One, 2, and 3, exactly right. So I had to ask, otherwise everybody would say, hey, you didn't ask him about Le Mans.
I would have been disappointed had you not asked.
So the materials that are used to build the GT, did you guys get learnings from race teams, or was this a situation where it was like you had internal knowledge and you had some race team knowledge and you brought it together and that's a consequence of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the knowledge comes from a variety of different places. But there's no doubt, I mean, we're using, you know, there's a high use of carbon fiber. I mean, that's not uncommon in race cars, you know, aluminum. In some of the active aero that we're going to have on the vehicle and whatnot, you know, this is all coming together from our experience, from the experiences of our race teams, and we're leveraging all of that to pull together the best car that we know how to build.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've got some questions coming in here from the audience, too. Dave Marsh twittered in to say, as a cord cutter, I see no racing coverage in my media streams. What are sponsors doing about our growing demographic? And, you know, I might become a cord cutter, too, i.e. cut the cable TV cord.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought there were some streaming things out there.
There are.
NBC Sports, I thought, had a streaming option.
Yeah, I mean, that's a reality that all the series have to face. Increasingly, people are just not sitting in front of a tube, so to speak, to watch. So mobility, access on the road, so...
But if you look at even like NASCAR, right, they've got several apps, RaceView being one of them.
Yep.
When the race goes live, you can absolutely watch it on your iPad or on your phone or whatever smart...
Hey, I got a NASCAR Ford question. Mm-hmm. You know, Roush Fenway has been associated with Ford forever and ever, and they've been successful.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, everyone's been talking about the dominance of, what's his name? I'm blanking out.
Roger Penske?
No. Chevy.
Let's talk about Roger Penske.
Hendrick. Yeah, we'll get to him in a minute. That's what everyone said. Hendrick Racing, you can't beat it. It's a juggernaut. They got all these teams. They all share everything. They supply other teams, too, and yada-da-da-da. And here comes Penske, goes with you guys last year, right? Wasn't last year?
2 years.
2 years ago.
Yeah. 2 years.
And bang, bang, you know, Keselowski goes out and wins the championship in 2012. Didn't he win, like, 5 races last year or something?
Seven races.
7 races.
Yeah.
And my question is, what is it about Penske Racing? I mean, and I'm not trying to, you know, to put Roush down because I know how hard those guys work, but here comes a two-car team and bang, They're successful right out of the box.
Yeah, John, I mean, I think, number one, all of our teams are doing fantastic, and we're really proud of what they've done, especially some improvements that we've made from the previous year. And if you look at what happened this year, all of our teams have won, whether it be Ganassi for, you know, the 24 Hours of Daytona, whether it be Roush Fenway for the Xfinity race that they won, or, you know, Penske winning the Daytona 500. I'll comment on Roger, and I'm sure so will Jamie. I mean, I think... You know, the Penske organization is very well run. I think it's very well organized. I think they have very clear goals and objectives, and I think everyone within that organization understands that and knows their role in making that happen. And so I think Roger does a really good job of focusing his team on what he wants to accomplish, and I think the results speak for themselves.
I mean, it is, I'll just add a little bit, because I echo everything Dave said, with the added layer, and that is, you know, there are cycles, right? There were times where Roush Fenway ruled
absolutely
the track.
Absolutely, it's true.
And so, and the great thing is that that team is still there. It's reinvigorated. We are providing our technical support, as we do with all of our teams. So we are very fortunate. We have really, truly an assemblance of teams who are capable at any point in time to succeed and win. So indeed, when you can compare, look across the aisle and see other teams who are, you know, bigger in terms of spread their distribution of chassis and engines across the garage, you know, with Roger's case, he's very focused on his teams. And with Roush Fenway's case, also revitalizing and focusing on adding some technical excellence. And then I think we'll be very surprised this year.
Were you guys holding your breath with all those restarts at Daytona?
Definitely when those cautions were coming, that wasn't what we wanted to see.
Uh-huh.
But
all Chevy's sitting there ready to
Yeah, but we had confidence in our teams. And
that was a phenomenal performance by Logano.
Yeah, I mean, once he got ahead, man, he was just way ahead.
He did some amazing driving. Yeah.
Daytona is unique, and you need the art of speedway racing, and you check out too far, they'll just gaggle you and, you know, pass you, as we saw it in the Xfinity race. But certainly, you know, you need the speed, you need the acumen, and you need a little bit of speedway racing, a little bit of right place, right time.
Yeah, that's called blocking.
But I'll tell you, you know, our teams are working really well together. If you look at the Xfinity race, right? The Penske team helped the Roush team actually get across the finish
line. I missed that race.
It was really fantastic. But teams are working well together.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Ben, we've got a phone call in here. So we've got a question for you guys from a phoner. Let's bring that in.
Hey, guys. This is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio. Got a question for the Ford honcho, the main man. When's the horsepower and torque rating coming out on that 5.2 Voodoo flat crank engine? And will that be offered in a crate? Is there a chance it might be a crate engine offering later on? And what about that supercharged version of the Shelby? Will that be offered as a crate engine down the road? Thank you.
That's a great question.
Later. Bye.
Great questions. Well, I mean, as far as the horsepower and torque rating, we're probably a couple months away from sharing that information. We're going through the final certification stages and whatnot now, and so we're probably about 2 to 3 months away from sharing that information with everybody. I'm very excited to share it, and I know that everyone will be happy about that. As far as a crate version of that, not currently in the plans, but, you know, we'll have to stay tuned on that. And I think your last question was a supercharged Shelby, and I'm not familiar with what that plan would be. So,
so explain this 5.2 engine that he's referring to, and it's a
flat plane crank.
So explain to the audience what that is, since you guys had never done a V8 that way before.
Yeah, I mean, well, a flat plane crank essentially. I mean, instead of the pistons being, you know, opposing at 180 degrees, they're at 90 degrees, and so what happens is that you end up putting the engine's going to rev a lot higher, and it's going to have a great torque band to it. But it comes with some challenges along the way because the vibrations that the engine produces are pretty significant. So you have to work through those engineering challenges. But what you get is you get the most powerful naturally aspirated V8 that we've ever produced at Ford.
And everybody talks about the exhaust note, that it's distinct.
The exhaust note is absolutely amazing. I mean, it is just you will never get sick of hearing the exhaust note on that. We were just at the track the other day, and anytime one of us would come down and hit the back straight, everybody would just smile. It didn't stop all day. So, yeah, it's really a fantastic engine. The 350 and 350R are amazing products, and I just can't wait to get it out in people's hands.
We've got another couple of questions here. Maybe I can consolidate them a little bit. But, Jamie, they especially want to know about NHRA, drag racing. Mm-hmm. They quote you here of saying Nitro Pro level and enthusiast sportsman level. Mm-hmm. What this guy's asking about, how do you support the enthusiast sportsman level? When can we expect the next Mustang Cobra jet?
Mm-hmm. So obviously there's a lot of passion in all forms of motorsports and a lot of passion in drag racing. So last year when we announced that we're, you know, suspending our support in the Nitro class from a sponsorship perspective, It really gave us an opportunity to spend more of our support on the sportsman class. And the way we support our sportsmen through a variety of functions. One is, obviously, we make available, we build these amazing Cobra jets that get snapped up just like that. We build, about 50 a year. They all get pre-sold, and they get snapped up. We also provide contingency, win contingency. If you win in a certain class with a 4-power, you get the reward of claiming a contingency for winning. And then access to a product and parts that you could use to go drag racing in your Mustang. So we have a full program around supporting sportsmen. And a lot of people think, oh, Ford and NHRA. Nope, I can tell you unequivocally, Ford and NHRA are forever bonded. I mean, drag racing and Mustang, that's the spirit of what Mustangs started out to be. And then we're in it forever and ever.
Carl Esposito wants to know, when can he order a Focus RS?
When can he order one? That's a great question. I don't know when the actual order banks are going to open. I don't have that information with me today. But, stay tuned. We've got a lot of demand for it, and I would assume that, you'll be hearing more from us for sure in the next 6 months or so.
I see we got a couple of more phoners. Ben, let's bring one of those in.
Hi, good evening. My name is Roger Gerwella. I'm from Warren, Michigan. Long-time watcher, first-time caller. Wondered if you could please ask your guests from Ford Performance the rationale behind dropping John Force and John Force Racing, including the up-and-comer Courtney Force, from their sponsorship. I think they lost a great commodity there, especially with Courtney being an up-and-comer, very marketable. Thanks very much. Love the show. Missed the beer, though, and missed the dog.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I used to have a dog. Yeah. He was part of the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I remember.
He was awesome.
I remember, yeah.
This is where we need the dog. No, I mean, this is one of those heart-touching stories, and that is, on one end, John Force, Courtney Force, Ashley, the whole Force family, they're friends, and we've been together for many years. So one never can deal with the fact of a business conditions when you're dealing with, personal situations. So while the bond with the Force family is a personal bond, at the end of the day, we as a company had to make a business decision around our ability to support at the sponsorship level. And at the end of the day, NHRA was founded on sportsmen, and it evolved into the Nycro class. So the spirit of what, our retention in NHRA remains. I know to a lot of not much satisfaction to those who love John Force, but at the end of the day, it was a tough business decision we had to make, and we know there's a lot of passion behind it.
Yeah, I mean, that's motor racing.
Yes.
It's never easy, and you got to make tough decisions.
Yep.
I definitely know how that all goes.
Yep.
Do you have spirited competition among your professional colleagues at Chrysler and GM?
We do.
Give us a little sense of what that's like. I mean, presumably you got to have bragging rights. I mean, you guys are probably, Sunday night just all about, the Logano's victory and Harvick coming in second. And, how does that go?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, first we'll talk a little bit about racing, and we'll talk about, product if you want. Because we're from here, so we travel to the races. We see our colleagues and on the same plane, traveling to the same races. And then we're inevitably at the starting line. We're inevitably there. So obviously we have a professional a commonality in that professionally, right? We both do the same thing. We both have the same objective. But when the flag drops on Sunday, we want one thing, right? We each want our brand to win. We each want our company to win. But what happens after the race ends, there's always a lot of camaraderie around the fact that, hey, congratulations, you won that race, and then on, we'll get you next time. So a professional competition, but at the end of the day, a lot of passion for what we all stand for, which is in the case, we stand for Ford, we wanted Ford to win.
You see that a lot in professional sports. That's one of the things I love about professional hockey is they all line up and shake hands at the end that. I think motor racing is very much along those lines, but even more so.
Yeah.
Because, there's a technical side, there's a business side, there's the drivers themselves, there's the crew and everything like that. And it just seems to be more of a community. You're traveling a lot. There's the drivers all bring their families or often will.
Yep.
And so to me, the racing community has probably more camaraderie than other sports do.
Yeah. Because you're, as you said, you're on the road a lot. They become, although they're competitors, you're part, you know, you're spending time with them up until the, you know, the flag dropped. So there's a lot of social connections that develops. And then you'd be surprised how sometimes the first person to come and congratulate the person who won is the other driver or the other manufacturer, say, hey, great job.
Right.
And we'll, on to next week.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, when we hit the, you know, we were sort of poking each other a little bit right at the driver's meeting right before the Daytona 500. Kind of jousting back and forth. But after the race was over and we were in the winner's circle, within the first 20 minutes or so, the Toyota team, their management, the Chevy guys, I mean, everybody came over, found us, shook our hands. Congratulations, guys. You guys had a great race. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's competitive, but we do the same thing, right? I mean, it's competitive, but like you said, it's a family. There's some camaraderie there. We're all in it for the same thing. We all have the same, you know, passion around what we're doing.
Right.
So, yeah.
But every chance you get, you put a boot in their face to lift yourselves up.
Of course.
Hey, we've got another phone call here. Let's bring that one in.
Hey, John. Paul Stewart.
We lost that. Ben?
Hey, John. Paul Stewart from Out West. One last question for the guys at Ford, I should say. I drove one of the original Ford Taurus shows back in 1989, I think it was, or 1988, from the old Northville dealership. I think it's gone now. Like I said, I'm out west. It was the sedan version, which they only had. Is there any chance? I don't think they will, because the hatchback seems to be winning for high performance for Ford, for the Focus and Fiesta. Is there any chance? I don't think they're going to do it, to put the hotter engines in the sedan for the little Fiesta or Focus. Love to buy it. I'd love to give you $30K of my money. I don't think it's in the cards. Like I said, I drove one of the original ones back in 89 at the Northville dealership. Just curious. I think hatchbacks are the ones to go with. But just want to see what they have to say. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you look at our strategy, we have several different versions of our cars. You know, some of them are sport versions. Some of them are, you know, the Torsho, and then we have the ST and the RS. So, I mean, we have different levels of power and performance throughout the entire Ford lineup. So I think, you know, in you say hatchbacks, I mean, we're already offering performance STs, the Fiesta and Focus STs and RSs. And what. So, I mean, I think we are putting performance engines in the hatchbacks and in the smaller cars.
I think he was wondering whether you'd put one in a Focus sedan.
I see.
That was my sense of what he was saying.
Versus a hatch.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought he wanted to see it. Well, you know, I mean, again, all of that is, I'm not going to talk about future product plans, but all of that is possible. It really depends on the demand from the customers and whether we think that that's where we should be putting our resources and our money versus another place. So we think we've got it pretty well covered right now, though, with the offerings that we currently have.
Is there a vehicle that you have in the Ford showroom that would not be a vehicle that you guys would work on?
Probably the Transit, although I wouldn't mind putting some slicks on that bad boy with some racing stripes. Probably the Transit, I don't know.
I've seen a Shelby striped on a Transit.
I have too.
Hey, look, we could have you guys here all night.
Yeah.
Easily. But I know you got to get back to world headquarters.
We got a meeting.
I know you got a meeting to do. So I hate to say we got to cut you loose. But Jamie Allison, Dave Parasek, thanks so much for coming on. This has been
great.
Awesome. The time just flew by. And we'll have to have you back at another point. So,
we'll be glad to go back.
Because
thanks
you guys are terrific guests here. I want to thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you for having us.
And now we're going to give a shout out to our good friends at Dow Automotive.
For the people at Dow, racing is a sport and a science. We enjoy one and learn from the other. But like most competitive people, we like winning at both. Working together, scientists and racing technicians study the impact of new lightweight materials. We look back and learn, so we understand a little better what's on the road ahead. This is the human element at work. Dow.
Man, what a great segment.
Told you that'd be fast.
Oh, that was, like qualifying speed fast.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting. Look, what they're saying is music to my ears. I love the fact that they're really integrating product development, research and development, racing. This is cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you made the point earlier that we've been hearing this for many, many years from OEMs in town that they're doing this. And
right.
it seems to me that we're really seeing a connection here with what they're doing. And, you know, Dave just coming off of the Mustang program and then, you know, heading up this initiative. So, I mean, he's an engineer who gets it. He understands cars. He understands the consumer market. And he obviously understands racing. And with Jamie working, you know, right along with him, I mean, man, what an awesome combination.
No, I'm really impressed. And I love this idea. You know, Ford's been talking the one Ford approach. And they're largely on the cusp of achieving that on a global mm-hmm. basis. And now to see them approaching their motor racing efforts and performance efforts that way, that's going to be a powerful combination.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we should tell the audience a little bit of what you and I were doing this week.
Yeah.
We got to drive the Honda HR-V.
Which we can't talk about.
Which, in fact, yeah, think about it. It's embargoed for 2 months.
2 months, yeah.
And I've never been to a vehicle launch where the embargo was for 2 months. 2 weeks, maybe. Never 2 months.
Back in the day, there used to be 2 months sorts of things when it was, you know, sort of the pre-internet era when, you know, it was all predicated on the long production cycles for magazines, which, you know.
It took 2 to 3 months for
you know,
you to go to a new car launch and it show up in print.
Right.
But of late, this is unusual. So
I do agree with that.
They had some production problems, you think, at the plant? I mean, because they plan out these media launches way in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And they think, oh, yeah, let's time it so that the journalists all write these great stories about our car, and then bang, the car is in the showroom.
Although I'm trying to remember that there was a program last year that it was either an Acura program or a Honda program that was actually delayed. There was, and I'm going to keep calling it Chrysler, FCALLC. I think the Cherokee program was
hugely delayed.
Because,
and we know why.
But there was a program scheduled, and then they just had to pull the plug on that, and then
because they had problems with the all-wheel drive system.
Yeah, so these things do happen. So even though they are planned well in advance, there are. But it was an interesting vehicle. I think we can't talk
about the driving impressions or anything.
They said
like
even
that.
None of the technology.
Well, none of the, you know, I take that with a grain of salt. The vehicle's on sale in Japan,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, the North American version's going to be different. There's a different engine and the like. But
I don't think we mentioned the name of it. It was the HR-V.
Yeah, HR-V. Right.
The Venzel in Japan. So.
Oh, is that what it's called? The Venzel.
Yes.
I think HRV probably is a better name.
It might mean something in Japan or so, who knows. But, yeah, so we were doing that. That was interesting. And
what do you think of how Honda's doing in overall? I mean, what's your sense?
I think that the folks that we talked to, Jeff Conrad over there, who's the senior vice president of American Honda now, I think that they get the sense that they know that they had basically lost their way and lost some of their stuff. And I think that they're very keen on gaining that back. And although we've only seen sketches of it, I mean, so they're going to do the Ridgeline, which, okay, was roundly criticized by lots of people.
Like, I loved it, actually.
But there were more people not like you in...
Yeah.
This profession
right.
than people like you.
Right.
And it's just like, you know what? This is something that we do, and so we're going to do it. And so I think they're, you know, they're working on it. I don't think that they, you know, feel that they've accomplished what they need to set out to do, but it's also very interesting that they did emphasize that if you look at car sales last year and you just look pure retail, that basically it's...
They're number one.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Accord,
right.
Civic, CRV,
yeah.
Bang, 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 Odyssey, bang,
right.
And right in there. So,
very interesting company. Probably the most unique of the mass market brands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, They don't want fleet, you know. They don't want long car loans. They march to the beat of a different drummer.
Right.
I find that fascinating, mm-hmm. and I admire it. I really like it.
Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking, and I think this is an interesting subject that we were talking a little bit yesterday when we were driving to the airport about the size of companies like Honda versus some companies that have grandiose goals of being the world's largest automobile manufacturer, and what happens to these companies should car sharing really take off,
yeah.
should autonomous vehicles really take off? What happens to these huge, far-flung manufacturing footprints?
Yeah.
And
That's worth a whole show in itself. Right? We're going to have to do that, too.
But you see that being a real problem for some
companies. I do. No, I think car sharing, or let's call it mobility services, is a mega threat to the industry as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a decade and a half out, the Earth is not going to need as many cars as it does today. And so those automakers with massive manufacturing footprints are the most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
So the ones who are at the top right now, Volkswagen, Toyota, General Motors, are probably the most susceptible to being hurt by this change.
Right, right. It's a big change. You know, we just had guests on from Ford, and I don't know if you saw the study that Ford came out with today about the Generation Z and what they're looking for in terms of automobiles and
Okay, wait a minute. I know Gen X. I think I know Gen Y.
All right,
Gen Z.
Gen Z, people born between 1993 and 2001. Small segment of new car buyers today, globally 2 billion people.
2001? How can anybody born in 2001 be driving a car already?
Well, this is what they're interested in. So basically, they're looking at 16-year-olds, 17-year-old, 18, 19, 20, and 21-year-olds. Okay,
uh-huh.
That's who they're looking at in this study.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's 21 and younger. And so they did this study, and it said Ford tops the list of vehicles most seriously considered at 8.2%, ahead of Toyota with 7.2% and Chevrolet with 6.4%. And I said, wait a minute. Okay, if the number one brand that's being considered is only 8.2%, you know, what's going on here? I mean, it's like, is there like no interest at all? And so I ended up getting the entire breakdown of the stats on it. It was very interesting to look at when you look at what people are interested in. So, I mean, if Scion had a 12.28% in the 16-year-old category, which is huge numbers by this study, Hyundai, this is remarkable, 20.15% 17-year-olds. Are thinking of that. I mean, just
Hyundai.
Wow.
And but is Ferrari on the list?
No.
Okay.
But it's virtually everybody else. I mean, and it's I mean,
all the mass manufacturing.
I mean, Porsche.
Uh-huh.
So if you aggregate all these numbers, yeah. its level of interest is 0.05% among Generation
what?
Z. 0.05%.
Whoa, let's go buy stock in Hyundai.
And but once you factor in all of these other things, Hyundai only comes out at 3.36%.
Oh.
Scion only comes at 1.56%.
So what do you mean factor in other things?
Well, because you factor in, so Hyundai is big with the 17-year-old.
Oh, but not other.
0% with the 16-year-olds. And then it drops when you're 18 years old, it's only 1.55% interested in Hyundai. So, I mean, it's very interesting how this thing
those
works.
Those data points are weird.
They're very weird. But, they're trying to make the argument that, you know, the kids are still interested in cars. But, what also seemed interesting is that they came out with the reason that they were most interested, 34% were interested in fuel economy to replace their cars. And there said nothing in here about how this generation was all interested in telematic systems or infotainment or mirroring their smartphones and on and on and on. So I think maybe some of these car makers are missing a beat by concentrating on that part of the technology curve that they don't do very well in, as we saw in the J.D. Power dependability study that just came out.
Yeah, talk about that, because J.D. Power and Consumer Reports came out this week.
Yes,
very. Saying, here are the best cars that you can buy.
Well, you know, it's one of the things that so for the J.D. Power, and this is the dependability, so this is the three-year sort of thing, and also the Consumer Reports is also a time-based study, not just pulling numbers out of a hat. But the thing that strikes me is interesting is that J.D. Power found 55% say that their vehicle would not recognize their phone, and 31% say their phone would not automatically connect with their vehicles, and they're saying those problems didn't go away. Which leads me to wonder, why is there continuing to be this emphasis among automakers to make their own systems? And doesn't this sort of lead right into, you know, the Apple's CarPlay or the, you know, the Google Android Auto or whatever the hell they're calling their thing, to say, take the head unit, you guys do it? Because, I mean, if this is causing their vehicles to be rated more lowly, because let's face it, a lot of people are looking at, well, you know, is this J.D. Power say that this is a good car to buy or not? And if the answer is no, but the reason for that no is because of the infotainment system, it sort of says to me that maybe the car makers ought to start looking at suppliers.
And I think that's going to happen. No, I think you're right. That's why they're bringing Apple and Google into their cars. The other thing I'd point out, though, is to your point, the J.D. Power dependability study, it goes back 3 years, or right. It looks at cars over 3 years. So you go back 3 years, that's when all this connectivity and infotainment stuff really started to go haywire. This is when Ford went from the top of the ratings to really bad ratings. Mm-hmm. And so it's not capturing necessarily what's going on right this moment.
Although it's interesting to note, however, that if you look at the nameplate rankings, Lexus is number one again in, you know, like the fourth year running, and Toyota is number three. We've got to give a shout out to Buick. They're number two, which is it's just, you know, phenomenal for those guys. But Toyota has basically said, we're sticking with our Intune system. We're sticking with our system. We're not going for these other guys. So the fact that, you know, we've seen some automakers have serious and continue to have serious problems in terms of their systems, these guys have basically, you know, stuck to their system, and it seems to
work out well for them.
You know? Yeah.
And I don't know how their system ranks, you know,
right,
Intune. But, you know, Toyota's philosophy has always been, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. In fact, if it works perfect, don't change a thing.
Right, right.
But you know what I find so amusing in a way is Consumer Reports looks at all these factors, reliability, blah, 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 and it comes out and it says, these are the best vehicles in their class. J.D. Power does something kind of very similar. It goes out and talks to all these consumers, right? And they say, here are the best vehicles in their class. They're not the same vehicles.
No, there is variation.
I mean, both these guys did all their studies. They went through everything, and they both come to different conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
I find that amusing.
Yeah, and so we heard some rumblings earlier this week about problems with some Teslas, and Tesla's number one in Consumer Reports.
Well, you know, it's the old argument that goes back years and years ago about Italian cars, Alfa Romeos in particular, not being reliable.
Mm-hmm.
But people still loved them.
Right.
When you look at brands like Volkswagen and Jeep, they often rank at the bottom of any of these quality surveys and at the top of loyalty studies.
Right.
You know, people love the vehicle, even though Consumer Reports and J.D. Power do not rank them very highly.
Mm-hmm. And so we can see here, in terms of the lowest scoring models, the Jeep Wrangler Limited is one of those lowest.
Yeah,
lowest,
and those people will be, you can have my Jeep Wrangler Limited when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers, mm-hmm. you know?
But, you know, it's like if you look at the ones that Consumer Reports, you know, has as top scoring. I mean, so you got the Tesla Model S, the BMW M235i, Mercedes-Benz S550 all-wheel drive, Porsche 911 Carrera S. I mean, it's like,
you're talking hardcore enthusiasts.
Yeah, and I mean, and come on, are you going to mess with any of those cars? I mean,
no, you know, so the, you know,
although the Impala makes it. Impala's on the list.
Look,
Stingray.
People I talk to that own those things love those Impalas. Mm-hmm. You get a lot of car for the money. So.
You sure do.
But it's
also a lot of money, though. So
they are a bit pricey. Yes, they are. So what else do you think is worth noting about what's happened in the industry this week?
It was pretty quiet. Overall, it was a very quiet week, I thought.
Right. Chip is saying we got a phone call here. Let's bring that in.
Hi, John. My name is Paul Stewart. I'm out west. Long-time watcher and listener, even when you were on PBS many, many years ago. I just noticed a press release from SCA today for the 200 model, which I like a lot, for a trans problem. You may have seen it, maybe not. They said there's a problem with parking problems or woes, whatever. It's with their new transmission. That's not the issue. My question is this. FCA, I saw in the press release, is blaming the issue on a supplier factory. So, like, on maybe Magna or BorgWarner, who knows. Is that a good tack to take? Is that a good way to blame someone else? Just curious. I'm not sure how honest you can be with your opinion. Because when I buy an FCA vehicle, you know, a Ram or Chrysler, I buy a Ram or a Chrysler or FCA product. I don't buy a BorgWarner or Magna car. Hey, great show and the best of Ford. Just curious, is that really a good route to take to blame somebody else even though you bought a part from somebody? Used to work for a supplier many years ago back in Michigan. I'm out west now. Great show. Take care. Bye-bye.
I had not seen that release or anything like that. No, I can look. I can be brutally honest. No, it's a big mistake for a car company to blame a supplier for a problem. You know, they sourced that supplier. They approved that supplier. They approved its design. They inspected the parts that came in. And to throw them under the bus is just trying to save their own neck. FCA is not the only one that does it. We had Oliver Schmidt here a week ago, and he pointed out that 70% of the value of a car is bought from suppliers. And, you know, if you're going to have a problem,
But not Volkswagen.
Well, yeah. Not according to Ollie, at least. But, if you buy 70% of the value of something from the outside, chances are that's where you're going to have your most problems or most recalls, potentially. But to answer your question, no, I think an automaker has got to stand behind its product. It shouldn't be, bring up something. You mentioned Jeff Conrad earlier from mm-hmm. Honda, and I asked him, I did an interview with him and was asking, you know, you guys have been excoriated in the media with these Takata airbags. And, you know, they can blow up with no warning whatsoever and kill people. And yet Honda just set an all-time sales record last year and last month as well. And, my question is, why have you not been impacted by this? And one of his reasons, he says, we didn't do a Texas two-step. We stepped up to the problem and did what we had to do. Now, Honda has not hidden the fact that it's a Takata problem, but they haven't really attacked, you know, and blamed the problem
right.
on Takata either. So,
I didn't see the release or the statement from Chrysler regarding the transmission, but I mean, I can imagine that maybe one of the things is that, okay, so the 9-speed transmission that they're using, the 200, is designed by a supplier, and they have, and I'm not sure if it goes in the 200 or not, but presumably it does if that's what they said in the statement. But, you know, they have the Kokomo plant. They're making 9-speeds there. The supplier's got a plant. It's making 9-speeds there. Maybe what the point was that not all 200s have the problem. That's maybe what I'm thinking of. But, you know, that's a possibility.
Could be. I mean, the caller's question, I think an automaker has got to stand behind its products and not blame, you know, somebody
right.
else who they knowingly and willingly source that product from. And Gary, we talked about this on the show, you and I have, that automakers never want to talk about suppliers when they come up with new innovative technology that the consumer loves. They all pretend the automakers do that.
They invented everything.
They did it all. But when something goes wrong, that's the company that you can blame. You know, they heap it onto the suppliers.
So. You know, and as we saw last year with all the problems that General Motors had with all those recalls, General Motors did very well last year in terms of overall sales.
But see, the GM thing I kind of understand because GM was, you know, attacked in the press. And the public hated what GM did with this, but you can't buy a GM car.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of understand where the public may not know exactly what brands GM has. But in the Honda case, with the Takata thing going wrong, it was Honda all the way. Honda this and Honda that. And mm-hmm. you can go out and buy Hondas. And yet they've gone on to have record sales despite this kind of a defect.
Good thing GM took those little GM logos off the sides of their cars.
Hey, look, it's about the time we started an hour ago, so I think it's time to wrap up here. But great seeing you.
Good seeing you.
That's right. We need to let everybody know that starting next Thursday, this show is going to be starting, the live portion is going to start at 3:00 in the afternoon. And we're doing that because from a production standpoint, we have to do this. We've been stretching things a little too thin here. And so by doing it in our normal working hours, we'll always have a full crew here. I'm not going to be here.
I'm going to be flying
back from the Geneva show. Who knows? If I get in early, maybe I'll pop in and, you know, we can talk about some of the things.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But I leave the show in your great hands.
John, thank you, and we'll take care of it.
Cool. Good deal.
Good seeing
you. Hey, thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.